Icky Strong, and this is VOA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report. For students going to Colby College in Maine next month, coronavirus testing is expected to be a normal part of campus life. Colby will require all students to take a coronavirus test every other day for 2 weeks and then 2 tests a week after that. The college says it will provide up to 85,000 tests over the next 4 months. That is nearly as many as the entire state of Maine has provided since the health crisis started. Colby is a private college of 2,000 students. It joins a growing number of colleges and universities in the United States announcing aggressive testing plans to identify COVID-19 cases before they spread. Harvard University says all students living on its campus will be tested when they arrive, and then 3 times a week. Boston University plans to test most students at least once a week. But whether schools should be testing every student, and whether they actually have the ability to do so, is a subject of debate. Some colleges plan to test students only if they show signs of the virus or come in close contact with someone who has tested positive. But researchers say that plan could quickly lead to infections caused by students who show no signs of the disease. As universities hurry to make plans for virus testing, U.S. federal officials are warning that they could overload laboratories that process tests for hospitals. In a call with governors, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said too many colleges are agreeing to deals with private laboratories. This threatens to jam up the system, he said. Instead, Azar said, colleges should develop testing operations in their own laboratories, especially at big research universities. College officials have been announcing testing plans as they work to ease concerns that they can reopen safely. For some, it is partly meant to show that officials will spend whatever it takes to keep their campuses protected. Doug Terp is Vice President for Administration and Chief Financial Officer at Colby College. He told the Associated Press that Colby's testing plan will cost an estimated $5 million. It's first and foremost to provide a safe environment. But truthfully, it's also to give all of us comfort, to give our local community comfort, and to give our students and families comfort, Terp said. But at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, officials question the value of such a plan. They argue that testing every student could create a false sense of security. Instead, the university plans to test students who show signs of the coronavirus or come into contact with it, and those in high-risk groups. Virus testing is just one of many safety measures colleges are planning as they look to reopen. Many plan to reduce class sizes, limit the numbers of students living in on-campus housing, require face coverings, and ban large gatherings. By testing, colleges hope to identify sick students and separate them from healthy ones to prevent the spread of the virus. For months, college and university leaders have argued that testing is extremely important to a safe reopening next month. But with limited guidance from federal officials, colleges have created a mix of plans based on advice from state agencies and on research from their own health experts. This Texas A&M University system recently announced that it will divide 15,000 tests among its campuses each month. The tests will only be given to those who show symptoms or come into contact with known cases. Harvey Mudd College near Los Angeles and McAllister College in Minnesota have similar plans. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, urges against widespread testing. It says colleges should mainly test students with symptoms. The CDC says broader testing should be considered only in areas with higher virus transmission rates. But researchers warn that depending on symptoms alone will not be enough. They say many young people carry the virus, but never feel sick. Without recognizing those cases, they say, the virus could quickly spread out of control. Recently, a Cornell University research team found that students would need to be tested every 7 days to keep infections down. A separate study from Yale University and the Harvard Medical School suggested that testing only once a week could lead to thousands of infections over a college term. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The Earth is a big place. The U.S. space agency NASA says the Earth has a diameter of about 12,800 kilometers. And the organization Population Reference Bureau estimates that about 7.5 billion people live on our planet. That is a lot of people. So it can really come as a surprise when you see someone in a place where you do not expect to see them. This can make the world feel very small. For example, let's say I travel all the way to Brazil for a vacation. Then at my hotel, who do I see? My coworker from back home, Katie. I have traveled very far from home only to see someone I know from home. That would be a great time to say, "Katie, fancy seeing you here. What a small world." It is always surprising to run into someone we know in a place as big as the world. We can say some form of small world to show this surprise. Now, sometimes events and people are connected in a surprising way. In these situations, we can also say small world. For example, let's say you make a new friend. You two met while playing on the same sports team. You start talking about where you live and what you do, and as the two of you talk more, you both find out that you have the same English teacher. You can say, "He's your teacher too? There are hundreds of English teachers. What are the odds? It is such a small world." These are all examples of coincidences. You were not expecting to find these connections between people, places, or events. And sometimes it is not always a pleasant surprise. Let's say I go to an art show in New York City. Now, on any given day, there are probably many art shows taking place in the Big Apple. But the one I go to just happens to be showing the artwork of my former boyfriend. Really? He's the artist? Small world. In a larger explanation, this expression means that although the world seems really big, we can still meet people we know in the most unexpected places. Usually, we say it's a small world to show surprise at a connection that seems unlikely, improbable, and against the odds. Generally speaking, it's a small world means that sometimes the world can feel a lot smaller than it is. And that can be a good feeling. It's a Small World is also the name of a water-based boat ride at Walt Disney Company theme parks. And it is the name of the song you hear throughout the boat ride. The ride shows children from around the world in traditional costumes. They are dancing, playing, and singing. On the Disney Parks website, Richard Sherman, the man who wrote the words to It's a Small World, talked about the song and what it means. Sherman said Walt Disney wanted a simple song, one that could be performed in English and many other languages. He added that people everywhere share the same feelings, so everyone should respect each other and love each other after all. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Richard Nixon. Nixon is well known to many Americans for one reason. He was the only president to resign from the position. Facing possible legal action by Congress, Nixon left office early in his second term. Yet Nixon's early political career was marked by success. He also had some noteworthy achievements during his White House years. And he attained his goal of moving the government in a more conservative direction. In his later years, Nixon and his supporters tried to reclaim his place as an expert on international affairs. But for many Americans, the name Nixon remains linked to distrust of national leaders, abuse of power, and political wrongdoing. Richard Nixon had a difficult early life. He was the second of five sons in a Quaker family. His parents owned a lemon ranch in California, near the city of Los Angeles. But the family struggled financially, and two of Richard's brothers died, one as a small child and one as a young adult. In time, his parents' business failed, and the Nixons moved to a nearby town. The parents and children all worked at a filling station that sold fuel and other products. Despite the many hours he worked at the store, Richard Nixon was a top student in high school. He was offered financial aid to attend Harvard University, but the family needed even more money to send him there. Instead, he attended a local college, where he became the student body president, joined a debate team, acted in the theater, and played football. Nixon went on to law school at Duke University in North Carolina. Even with his impressive background, he did not get the jobs he sought at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, or top law offices. So he returned to the California town where he grew up and began working as a lawyer. There, he married another actor at the community theater. Her name was Thelma Ryan, but she was called Pat. The Nixons went on to have two daughters, Tricia and Julie. In 1942, Nixon accepted a job with the federal government in Washington, D.C. He did not stay in the position long. After the United States entered World War II, Nixon joined the Navy. He served as an officer in the Pacific. When he returned to the U.S., Republican Party officials asked him to be a candidate for Congress. Nixon agreed. He won two terms in the House of Representatives, and then a seat in the U.S. Senate. 2 years later, Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican presidential candidate, asked Nixon to be his vice president. The two men won in an electoral landslide, and in 1953, Nixon took office as vice president. He was only 40 years old, the second youngest vice president in U.S. history. Nixon's early political career is remembered for several reasons. One is how quickly he rose to high government office. Another is for his part in the Alger Hiss case in the late 1940s. Hiss was a top official in the State Department. He was accused of being a communist in the 1930s and 1940s, and of passing information about the U.S. government to Soviet spies. Hiss denied the accusations. The case was big news in the United States. It showed the clash between people who believed Hiss was falsely accused as a way to discredit liberal policies and people who believed the government was protecting communist sympathizers. Nixon was in the second group. He was part of the investigation against Hiss and pushed for his indictment. Nixon's efforts succeeded, and Hiss went to jail for almost 4 years. Later, Nixon said that the case was one of the reasons for his rise to power. Nixon also earned national attention with an event that has become known as the Checkers Speech. It happened in 1952, when Nixon was running for vice president. Some reporters accused Nixon of corruption. They said he was accepting money and gifts from wealthy donors in exchange for his political support. Nixon went on television to deny the claims personally. At the time, Americans were not used to seeing politicians speaking directly to the public. Yet Nixon spoke informally and emotionally from what appeared to be a home. He explained his family's finances. He said he did not accept campaign donations for personal benefit. But he added there was one exception. A supporter had once given the Nixon children a black and white dog they called Checkers. Nixon said he refused to return his daughter's pet. The public and Republican Party officials loved the speech. Nixon appeared warm and likable. Middle-class Americans especially said they could relate to him. Most forgot the claims against him, and Nixon's political career was saved. During the following 8 years, he served as vice president in the Eisenhower administration. But then, Nixon's luck turned. In 1960, Nixon lost as a presidential candidate to John F. Kennedy. He blamed, in part, the media. Then in 1962, he lost his efforts to be governor of California. Nixon said he was retiring from politics. He famously told reporters, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore." Yet, 7 years later, he was in the White House. It was one of the most memorable comebacks in U.S. political history. When Nixon took office in 1969, some Americans thought the country was in crisis. The economy was not doing well. Race riots had been erupting in big cities. Many people were still trying to recover from the violence of a year earlier. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. and President John F. Kennedy's brother Robert had both been shot and killed. Pollution of the environment was becoming a major political issue, women were pressing for equal rights, and many Americans continued to protest American involvement in Vietnam. Nixon took action. During his first years in office, he supported reforms and rules to improve the economy, protect the environment, increase workplace and other opportunities for women, support civil rights, and, in his words, bring peace with honor in Vietnam. But for the most part, Nixon did not have the support of Congress to enact legislation. So he expanded the power of the presidency to carry out his goals. He is remembered especially for three foreign policy moves. In 1972, he visited China, with which the U.S. government had tense relations since the Chinese Communist Party took power. As the Alger Hiss case showed, Nixon was strongly anti-communist, but he made establishing diplomatic relations between the two sides possible again. He also visited the Soviet Union and was the first U.S. president to visit Moscow. Nixon and the Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, agreed to limit the growth of nuclear arms. Their actions helped ease tensions at a time when U.S. officials were worried about the expansion of communism. And Nixon did succeed in reaching a peace agreement with North Vietnamese leaders. In 1973, American troops slowly began to leave the country, although fighting there continued. Nixon's foreign policy achievements helped him in the 1972 election campaign. His first presidential election had been extremely close. The second he won by one of the widest electoral vote margins in U.S. history. Even though he was popular with voters, Nixon had been concerned about his political future. Nixon was so worried that, before the election, he created a secret team to prevent any damaging information from reaching the media. Later, its job expanded to include investigating any information that might hurt his public image. About 5 months before Election Day, five men broke into the opposition party's headquarters at the Watergate, a hotel and office complex in Washington, D.C. The team had already stolen copies of secret campaign documents. Now, in the middle of the night, the men were trying to add listening equipment to the telephones. In other words, spy on the opposition. But a security guard became suspicious and called the police. The men were caught and arrested. When the story came to light, Nixon publicly denied that any White House officials were involved in the crime. But in time, the public learned that Nixon was lying. In fact, he assisted with payments to the men who were arrested. And he tried to use the Central Intelligence Agency to block an FBI investigation of the crime. Nixon knew that the Watergate break-in was only part of the illegal or questionable acts he could be held responsible for. Later, people connected with Nixon told investigators that the president had taped everything that happened in his office. Investigators demanded the tapes. They would prove how much Nixon knew about the illegal operations. The president refused. He dismissed the lead investigator. Two other Justice Department officials resigned in protest. A new investigator was appointed, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered Nixon to release the tapes. At the same time, the House of Representatives voted to remove Nixon from office. They charged him with obstructing justice, abusing his power, covering up a crime, and violating the Constitution. Finally, Nixon released the tapes. But before the Senate could hold a trial, in which the president would almost certainly be found guilty, Richard Nixon resigned. He left the White House the following day. Nixon lived for 20 more years. He wrote a number of books, traveled, spent time with his family, and offered foreign policy advice to other leaders. He continued to deny that he had done anything criminal as president. Instead, Nixon said he had made bad decisions. And he did not go to trial. The next president, Gerald Ford, used his power to pardon Nixon for all offenses against the United States. But Nixon's image was permanently damaged. Most people found evidence in the tapes that Nixon knew about a related series of crimes, commonly known as Watergate. They also found that some of his public statements were dishonest. They said he made them to forward his own political goals, not to further the public good. As a result, Nixon's place in U.S. history is generally thought to be a troubled one. To be sure, he made a number of positive accomplishments, both within the U.S. and internationally. But his presidency left the country shaken. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.